For multiple decades now, institutions have been increasing their allocations to alternative assets for their income, diversification, and total return benefits. Now that we're seeing the world of alternative investing open up to a wider investor pool, it's important to look at how institutions have historically used these assets to enhance portfolios. Joining me today to talk about her experience working with institutional investors and using alternatives in portfolios is Catherine Pascalone, client advisor within our North America institutional business here at JPMorgan Asset Management. So Catherine, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, David. Excited to be here.
So before we dive in, can you describe your role at JPMorgan Asset Management?
Absolutely. So I've been spending the last 15 years working with some of our largest pension funds across the US, many of whom have been investing in alternatives going back multiple decades. So looking forward to the conversation here with you today.
And so the 15 years is, I guess, a fairly long time with institutional investors. How's the space kind of evolved over that time?
Yeah, so I'd say there's two key themes driving the alternative landscape for institutional investors over the last 15 years. First, I think, you know, a lot of them have increased their exposure to alternatives. And second, the definitions of what it means to be an alternative has expanded. The objectives themselves haven't necessarily changed. So, you know, folks want a desire to diversify their portfolio and seek higher returns relative to public markets. But how they go about doing that has certainly changed. So, you know, some of our institutional investors today are investing in alternatives upwards of 40% of their overall portfolio. And so a lot of that growth has happened in the last 15 years, and we can go into the reasons why. But, you know, it began as sort of a investment and focus on private equity and real estate, and as really the cornerstone of the allocations. And since then has expanded and seen tremendous growth in areas like private credit, real assets, and hedge funds in some cases.
So alternatives have grown as both as a share of portfolios and also just the diversity of alternatives that people are investing in. So what are some of the lessons that you've learned over those 15 years in terms of the things that institutions do right and I guess do wrong or mistakes they make?
Yeah, I think a lot of the lessons we learn happen in periods of market stress, right? When things are the hardest, we take a hard look at what we've done and some of the lessons that we've learned over those periods. And so I'd say there are kind of three key lessons that we think about. One is vintage year diversification. And so, you know, it is very difficult to pick the bottom or top entry point of when you're supposed to be accessing alternatives. And so having consistency and discipline around how you think about investing year in and year out is really important because, you know, when things are the scariest, oftentimes those can be the best environments for longer term investments. Second is really understanding the liquidity of an investment. You know, we can talk about the duration of a alternative asset class, but when, you know, when things are going wrong or when there is a drawdown, oftentimes we think we can get liquidity in certain vehicles and liquidity dries up. And so making sure you really understand what the risks are around liquidity or illiquidity in this case. And lastly, you know, a key reason why people invest in alternatives is for the correlation benefit. So, but as we all know, when there are periods of market stress or drawdown, correlations can go to one. And so really understanding what is truly uncorrelated versus things that can exhibit some additional beta to broad markets when things go wrong. And so I'd say those are kind of the three key areas of focus that our investors have looked at over the recent correction in the last couple of years.
Interesting. When you mentioned vintage year diversification, it sort of reminds me of just dollar cost averaging for individual investors. You know, it's you've got to keep putting the money in, and actually the years that feel lousiest to put the money in is probably when you're getting the best deals.
That's absolutely right.
Have you found that institutional investors are, first of all, are they truly making strategic decisions or does it tend to be a little bit tactical? And then when they think about an overall allocation, how rigidly do they stick to that allocation?
Yeah, so I think having a plan in place is always important, right? So setting the strategic asset allocation is an important component of having a disciplined process to investing. And as we know, you know, it can take a long time to ramp up exposures to alternatives. And so having that long-term view, having that strategic asset allocation discussion is really important. But that doesn't mean that you can't express more tactical views through your alternative investments. In fact, we see a lot of clients identifying trends today that they want to take advantage of in the longer term. So think about things like a lot of the changes we've seen within technology and the focus around artificial intelligence, some of the huge moves and transformations that are taking place within healthcare. You know, these are key areas of focus for our investors today, and they look to the private markets to be able to exploit some of these opportunities, especially when you've seen, you know, certain run-ups within the public markets. And so I think it's both. You need to have that strategic plan around how you think about getting invested in certain areas, but you can take shorter-term views on what you think is really driving the economy today and into the future.
And you know, one of the things when we were talking earlier, you mentioned is, you know, people aren't just diversifying into alternatives, they're diversifying within alternatives. And I know our own work on our guide to alternatives, which we put out every quarter, you know, it has always struck me just what an extraordinarily diverse group of assets these are. So are investors paying more attention to those very different qualities and how they can provide diversity within the alternative space?
Yeah, it's, you know, we talk a lot to your point around the diversification benefits to public markets, but even within alternative investments, there are diversifying properties within themselves, right? And so a lot of the discussions we have with clients are around, you know, what are the goals and objectives of private equity, private credit, real assets, hedge funds. And then within those overarching objectives, how do you create resilient portfolios underneath the hood? And so, you know, a lot of that comes down to having a healthy mix between more core and more non-core types of exposures, and looking at, you know, different parts of the global economy to get exposures within sub asset classes. And so it's not just about getting a beta in alternatives, right? It's about having those objectives at the top of the sub asset class, and then figuring out how to exploit different risks within real assets. As an example, you know, you can look at real estate as a great cornerstone of the investment, and then look at areas like transportation and infrastructure, you know, timber for certain investors, as ways to sort of round out that exposure and create diversification within the asset class. So there's lots of different things you can do, and we could go on and on about the different alternatives. But I think, you know, understanding that not only picking one is a great idea and a great first move, but there's lots to be done kind of across more broadly private markets.
Another thing I remember we talked about earlier was the what you call the denominator effect, and why, you know, sometimes years where it's pretty hard to raise funds and low fundraising years are actually pretty good vintages to be in. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. So, you know, a lot of our clients, let's just take, you know, the last few years as an example. You know, they made investments in alternatives. They had a long-term plan of where they wanted to get to, but then correlations went to one in public equities and fixed income, and things, you know, kind of took a turn, and you saw a drawdown in public markets, which meant that their private markets became an outsized portion of their portfolio. And so we call that the denominator effect, where in many cases, you know, they are handcuffed in terms of what they can do because they have some illiquidity challenges. And so, you know, in those periods of market stress, fundraising can be a lot lower because clients don't have as much capital to put to work. But if you look at the other side of that, when fundraising is lower, it means that funds are active and looking for investments. And oftentimes they have their pick of assets because competition is lower. And so that can oftentimes lead to a more attractive entry multiple. You know, we saw this in private equity post the dot-com bubble or during the GFC. In real estate, you saw it, you know, after 2011, when things were, you know, kind of reaching the tail end of the crisis, there was a great recovery that investors were able to participate in. And so, you know, when there are those periods of market stress, when people are faced with the denominator effect, like we talked about, it can be difficult to deploy capital. But, you know, history should suggest that it can oftentimes lead to more attractive investment opportunities on a go-forward basis.
I know, having spent a lot of time talking to investors about public markets over the years and dealing with public market portfolio managers, that when I talk to you and your colleagues in the alternative space, it's almost like there's a different mindset about investment goals and how to invest. Can you talk a little bit about them? You know, there are a lot of people who are new to alternatives, or we think should be new to alternatives and should be allocating some money to alternatives. But what should they think about in terms of how to think about this asset class and how that is different from public markets?
Yeah, so I think there are two things, one of which we've talked about a little bit, which is just taking that long-term view and being able to invest, over a business cycle. So it's easy to say that in the beginning, but really having that disciplined approach and understanding that it's going to take a long time for a lot of these things to play out. And so, taking that long-term view is a key tenet. But then the other piece of the puzzle is really thinking about manager selection. So it is even more important in the area of alternatives, where you can see wide dispersion within certain asset classes of manager returns. And so, identifying managers here can oftentimes lead to just a big, swing in terms of what your expected returns can look like. So looking at managers who have been able to manage through those business cycles, as we talked about, who have, the resources to be able to identify and invest in certain opportunities, and just making sure you're doing that diligence. Obviously, that's important in public markets, but I'd say it's even more pronounced in the area of private markets. And so having those two key tenets, and then of course understanding the risks involved in alternatives. You can oftentimes have, good returns, but it doesn't come without risk. So
Well, yeah, I think that's terribly important. I mean, it's for a long time we had very low interest rates. We've had solid growth. There's been a lot of money pouring into alternatives. It seemed like an easy space, but I always feel that manager skill is so much easier to discern in a down market when things get tough, because a lot of people confuse intelligence with the bear market. Oh, sorry, with the bull market, and it's not necessarily that way. So it's ter we in our guide to alternatives, we have a chart which looks at the dispersion of returns within alternative asset classes relative to the public markets. And it's completely night and day. It makes such a huge difference who the manager is. And then getting back to liquidity, I mean, one of the key aspects of alternatives has always been, well, these are not liquid assets. You just can't get in and get out, get in on Tuesday and get out on Friday. That's just not what it's about. But we have some newer funds which are evergreen, as people think a little bit more about why high net worth individuals ought to be able to invest in alternatives, should be investing in alternatives. A lot of companies, including our own, have come out with evergreen funds which allow people to get in and out or give some amount of liquidity. Can you talk about how much liquidity this involves, or and then is there a downside to these evergreen funds? You get lower returns because you have that liquidity.
yeah, you've seen this tremendous growth in alternatives, of course, but more specifically within these evergreen funds, and they've become popular specifically in areas like private credit and real assets. So think about more income-producing types of strategies, and I think there are a few things driving that. One, investors can get more immediate exposure to the fund's assets, while in closed-end funds, you are taking on blind pool risk in many cases, so you're not able to underwrite the existing portfolio, and you're hoping that a manager kind of follows the objectives that they laid out in the beginning. Second, LPs can stay invested and have more control over when they choose to redeem out of a fund vehicle when you're in an evergreen or open-end fund structure, because there are different types of liquidity provisions rather than in a closed-end fund when, there's a specific desired duration of the fund. And at the end of that duration, assets are sold and money is given back to an investor. And so this allows you for more flexibility around when you choose to either redeem or stay invested in the evergreen vehicle. And then lastly, because you're oftentimes investing in a more seasoned portfolio of assets and you're able to stay invested, the effects of compounding can be much more pronounced than in closed-end vehicles. And so we tend to see investors focusing on evaluating multiples of invested capital in areas like evergreen vehicles, which can really lead to a good, healthy return. Of course, on the other side of the equation, you mentioned kind of how to think about the trade-offs. Closed-end funds can oftentimes be a better vehicle for more value-add or opportunistic types of strategies, because you have to take a longer view in order to realize higher returns in the types of assets that they're investing in. So definitely a trade-off, but I'd say for more income-producing assets, evergreen vehicles can be a great solution for investors.
And so these evergreen vehicles, do they have sort of a limit to how much liquidity they would provide overall in a given quarter, or given here?
Yes, exactly. So, it kind of depends on the strategy, but I'd say in, certain cases, evergreen vehicles will provide that yield to investors on a quarterly basis, as an example, and then give you options over certain durations to either redeem your capital or reinvest it. But as we kind of talked about in the earlier parts of our discussion, that can change if the market environment changes, right? So if there are periods of stress, those liquidity provisions can kind of change a little bit. So just making sure, again, you understand those risks and look at these as longer term holds, I would say that would be a better
Well,
viewpoint for it.
it makes a lot of sense. So if you've got some idiosyncratic personal liquidity need, which is unrelated to the market, then you may be able to get some liquidity from these funds. But if everything's down and everybody wants their money at the same time, it's not going to work, nor should it, because
Exactly.
the whole point is find your liquidity somewhere else. Because a big portfolio you should have plenty of liquid assets as well as less liquid assets, and alternatives always will have some limitations to liquidity because these are long-term investments.
Exactly. Absolutely.
And then finally, this has been very interesting, but we're going into a new year here, and looking across the whole swath of alternative asset classes, where are you seeing institutional investors wanting to increase their allocations, and where are they trying to pull back a bit?
Yeah, so as we talked about, this has been an area where institutional investors have been allocating for multiple decades, and so a lot of the investing that they're doing, I would call it as more fine-tuning across different areas. So if we think about private equity, very mature portfolios in some cases, and so the types of investing that they're doing is more adding around the edges. So thinking about thematic plays where they have that broad-based exposure, and maybe they're looking for investments in areas like technology or healthcare, or perpetually underweight parts of their portfolio where they're looking to have more specific sector exposure. In areas like real assets, as we also talked about, real estate has been a stalwart within their program. And so looking at other areas that can deliver on that diversification or inflation protection or current yield have been the areas of focus for a lot of our institutional investors. So infrastructure and transportation are two examples of where we've seen a lot of interest from our clients. And then within private credit, that is, while a newer asset class, institutional investors have been very busy in the last 10 years there. So a lot of folks have deployed money into direct lending. And so now looking at, how do I complement my direct lending strategies, maybe taking on similar risk, but doing it in a different way, or seeking, relatively higher returns in more flexible mandates. So think about ways to exploit special situations or stressed environments, more flexible solutions to help round out direct lending. And then within hedge funds, I know that's more of a controversial topic, but certainly an area where you can get liquidity within alternatives in otherwise more illiquid vehicles. And so looking at hedge funds as a way to provide those or uncorrelated sources of returns, but doing it in a more liquid manner than some of the other private markets has been a focus for institutional investors. So really re-underwriting the principles of hedge funds, figuring out how to lower some of that public equity beta within their programs, and looking for uncorrelated sources of return.
So it sounds like institutional investors are taking an increasingly sophisticated approach to a very diverse allocation to alternatives. And indeed, as we know, a lot of high net worth individual investors are also getting into the space. So I think it sounds like it's going to be an exciting year for alternatives in 2025.
Yes, absolutely. Lots to do, lots to talk about, and lots of different ways to invest. So I think it's going to be an active year for a lot of our clients.
I'm sure we'll be talking to you over the course of the year and see how it turns out. But again, thank you very much for joining us, Catherine.
Thank you, David. Appreciate the time.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by J.P. Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.